Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. As listeners know, especially Deep Cut ones, I've interviewed a lot of founders, venture capitalists, and tech proselytizers on this show. I've interviewed A16Z's Marc Andreessen, Sri Ramakrishnan, and Catherine Boyle. Matthew Ball came on to talk about the metaverse. David Sachs of the All In podcast came on Ukraine. Keith Raboy and Mike Solana from Founders Fund, Peter Thiel's VC fund, made an appearance. Plus, we had Jill Lonsdale. Of course, Ashley Vance came on a few months back to talk about the privatization of space. Since I like to have friendly interviews of people that have different points of views on different topics, I wanted to speak with someone who doesn't quite see tech with the same rose-shaded glasses as everyone I just listed. That said, I also didn't want to just have that conversation with any old critic who could be easily dismissed as an angry journalist throwing stones from the rafters. My guest today, Jonathan Taplin, perfectly fits the bill of what I was looking for. He's the author of The End of Reality, How 4 Billionaires Are Selling a Fantasy Future of the Metaverse, Mars, and Crypto. He's worked across every industry and cultural wave of the last century. He was Bob Dylan's tour manager in the 60s and participated in the civil rights movement, produced films of Martin Scorsese and Gus Van Sant in the 70s, helped save Disney from a hostile takeover in the 80s, plus worked with Merrill Lynch on media acquisitions on Wall Street, and created the first video streaming service in the 1990s. Today, he's the director emeritus of USC's Annenberg Innovation Lab and the chair of the Americana Music Foundation. If you're particularly interested in Jonathan Taplin's background, which we spent a decent amount at the start of the show discussing, I highly recommend his recent book, The Magic Years, Scenes from a Rock and Roll Life. On the tech side, there's plenty to disagree with him on, especially when it comes to Mars and space, but there's a lot to take away from this conversation, even if you are a big fan of the tech categories he criticizes. Of course, a huge thank you to the Foundation for American Innovation for supporting the work of this podcast. Hope you all enjoy the conversation. Jonathan Taplin, welcome to The Realignment.
Good to be here, Marshall.
Listeners know that I usually like to dive right into book, whether it's a biography or a policy proposal or kind of a manifesto. And I tend to avoid getting into the biographies of the authors, but I think your background is so key to the conversation we're about to have. Can you start us off in your high school years? You know, you're at boarding school, civil rights movement, all the way into the 80s and 90s, rather than have me just try to recite it in 10 seconds over the introduction.
Yeah. You know, I grew up in the early 60s, you know, went to boarding school. It was an all-white, all-WASP school. And at some point, I got deeply involved in a group called the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was John Lewis and Bob Moses were the two progenitors of that movement. And it was kind of the youth wing of the civil rights movement. And I ended up writing, as I was the managing editor of the school paper, that the school should integrate, which caused a lot of trouble. But ended up happening. So that was a good thing. And then in the summer of 1965, I had graduated from boarding school and was on my way to Princeton. And I went to the Newport Folk Festival, which was the year that Bob Dylan decided to go electric on stage, which was a kind of one of those break moments in the culture. The folkies had been very politically involved, but it was all acoustic music and acoustic instruments. And bringing rock and roll on the stage of the Newport Folk Festival was a kind of an apostasy. the fans booed. I had gotten a backstage pass and had been introduced to Bob's manager, Albert Grossman. and was working for one of Albert's other groups, the Jim Creston Jug Band. So I was kind of very close to the whole thing. And when Bob decided literally on the spur of the moment to go electric, I helped set up the stage and everything because they needed an extra road manager. And then my career with Albert Grossman continued from there. I would go on weekends to do road managing gigs. Princeton was still an all-male college in those days, and so it was much more fun to go out on the road.
The opportunity cost was about as low as it was ever going to be.
Right, right. And then I'd drag my butt back to Princeton Sunday nights and go to school. And then I worked for Judy Collins. I worked for Janis Joplin. And then the band had made an album called Music from Big Pink. And they asked me if I would be their tour manager. And this was in late 68. And I said yes. And then I graduated in 69 and went to work full time for Bob Dylan and the band. And so that was an extraordinary time. Went to England, the Isle of Wight with Bob, met the Beatles, you know, just it was the magic flowering of that period. You reference a book I wrote about it called The Magic Years. And then I did that for 3 years. And then George Harrison asked me to produce the concert for Bangladesh. I did that. When Bangladesh was all over, I realized that none of the musicians I really loved were still touring or wanted to tour. And so I had a inkling to go to California and see what was happening in the movie business. And I was so naive, 24-year-old kid. I didn't know you weren't supposed to spend your own money making movies. I never had heard of OPM, other people's money. And I met a young film editor named Marty Scorsese. He had a script which became Mean Streets, and I myself and a friend financed it for $500,000. And then I was a movie producer. And fortunately, Marty made a great movie. And I was able to get my money back and do quite well on the movie and continued to produce movies for about 10 years. Found myself at Walt Disney in the mid 80s. And a guy named Saul Steinberg started a corporate raid on Walt Disney, and he expressed his intention to break it up, split it into parts, sell them off. And I got some friends in Texas, kind of near where you are in Fort Worth, the Bass Brothers, to essentially save the mouse. They invested and sold their real estate arm to Disney and put enough stock in friendly hands. And so they paid me as their investment advisor, and they paid me more money than I'd made in 5 years for 3 weeks' work. And so they said, why don't you go to work for our real investment banker, Merrill Lynch? And in those days, when the Bass Brothers told Merrill Lynch to hire someone, they did. And so I went to work for the Mergers and Acquisition Group. Did that for 4 years. Did some interesting deals. Viacom, you know, helped Sumner Redstone. But ultimately missed the creativity. And in the early 90s, went back to making movies with a German director named Wim Wenders. And then I made a movie with Gus Van Sant called To Die For. And then in the mid-90s, I came up with this idea of a streaming video on demand platform and built that called Entertainer. Microsoft and Intel invested about $100 million. We were doing pretty well in the early 2000s. And then the major studios who were giving us all the movies decided they didn't want another competitor in that space. And so they just stopped giving us the movies. And so we had to close it down. And I sued them all in federal antitrust court. And so needless to say, I couldn't go back to being a movie producer. And so the dean of the Annenberg School at University of Southern California said, well, why don't you come teach? And so I did. and then I won the antitrust suit 3 years later so I could afford to teach, and stayed at USC for another 10 years, formed something called the Annenberg Innovation Lab, and then started writing books. I wrote a book called Move Fast and Break Things, which was really the first techlash book, so to speak. And that brings us to where we are now. You know, this is my second book on that subject.
And this is the key thing. The reason why I wanted you to give folks the full spectrum of your career, once again, I really recommend The Magic Years, is that I don't know if you've seen the Chamath Palihapitiya man in the arena discourse. He's basically, all these people are coming after Chamath because of his SPACs and how the deals haven't been great for retail investors. And his basic pushback has just been, look, like, I'm in it. I'm in the middle of things. I'm in the arena. This is the Theodore Roosevelt quote. And all of you guys are basically a bunch of critics throwing, you know, tomatoes at me from the stage. And I think the key thing is that you are a critic of the technology industry who very much has been in the arena. So I think just up front, we can kind of dispense with a lot of the immediate pushback to some of the press offices of venture capital firms who I tend to book guests from, because that's a very key thing. So let's really start here. I wanna focus on the end of the reality, the book here. You're critiquing four different visions of the future. We're getting into Web3, crypto, space, and transhumanism. I'm gonna kind of go with the metaverse. I'm gonna go in a kind of not exact order here and ask you a question about the metaverse. So you were a founder and CEO in the digital streaming space. You're critiquing Zuckerberg's efforts to build the metaverse. It's not there. Users are interested, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But your own efforts in the space, 90s to 2000s, did not work out. So given that fact, I worry if we just dismiss the early failures of the metaverse, we're like someone at Blockbuster 2003 saying, oh, look, see, the streaming services will never secure long-term IP or cooperation from the studios. Therefore, our model is secure. So how do we separate initial business failure and, let's just say, dead ends from technology in the long term winning out over the status quo?
Well, my critique of the metaverse is that it just doesn't make any sense. Do you, Marshall, want to spend 7 hours a day with a virtual reality helmet on? In other words, Zuckerberg's business plan, which he told Ben Thompson, you know, the famous analyst, was that every minute that you now spend in front of a screen, you would spend in the metaverse, in his vision of what the future is. And so the problem is, even the people who make it don't want to spend that kind of time in the metaverse. As you can see from the book, one of the leaders of the team said, why aren't you, to his team members, why aren't you going into the metaverse? And when you go into Horizon Worlds, the virtual world they've created, there's almost nobody there. It's like a ghost town. So the problem is, you know, Andreessen says, well, we need more fantasy. The reality has not been a good construct for us. And I disagree. You know, I mean, my basic critique of all of these things is that technology has a real role to play in fixing the planet, whether it's, you know, carbon issues or whether it's lack of housing. There's a wonderful company right in the town that you live in, that builds 3D printed houses that cost $65,000 to build a small 3D printed house. And in LA, we're spending $600,000 to build housing for homeless people for each house. So there's many ways that technology can help us. But these guys, whether it's Musk or Zuckerberg or Andreessen or Thiel, seem to be intent on creating some kind of new reality of escape. Musk believes the planet is essentially dying and we need to have a new planet. So we got to spend $10 trillion to go to Mars. Well, that's absurd. Think of what we could do with $10 trillion in terms of, you know, making sure that we have an energy future that really works. So my criticism with the metaverse is more that it doesn't make any sense. And the second thing is that it's basically taking you all the problems we see that social networks have caused. And let's just take young girl suicides or young girl self-harm or things like that. All of these are going to be exacerbated by the metaverse. Because, look, it's one thing to be on a social network, somebody, and I know that face of Marshall is actually Marshall. But if I'm dating somebody in the metaverse and I've created this avatar that has nothing to do with my real look, right? I've basically taken Chris Hemsworth's body and put it on my, you know, with my thing. And the girl is not sure if that's me or what the real me is. Neither of us want to actually meet the real person. We want to stay in this fantasy. This has been proven by survey after survey of people who have tried to do this online virtual reality dating. So I don't think that's healthy. And I think the biggest problems that we're facing are problems of you know, just humanism. That's why the whole transhumanism thing is so worrisome to me.
And we'll get to transhumanism in a second, but I just want to put a pin on the metaverse conversation, given the Blockbuster versus Netflix metaphor. The key thing then is if it's 2004, the Blockbuster executive is incorrect, because at a core level, streaming made sense. People are in their homes, they have cable, they have satellite, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They have the internet. At a logistical level, obviously, folks would like to take that to the logical conclusion and be able to watch, rent, et cetera, videos that way versus driving to their local Blockbuster 8 miles down the road. So it would be a bad idea to dismiss something that fundamentally makes sense because there have been some temporary business hiccups. Your point on the metaverse is, even if Mark Zuckerberg perfects the perfect business model, the perfect microtransaction for every single new, let's say it costs you $10 or 10 Bitcoin or 10 ETH to like get the Chris Hemsworth body, that's not his problem. His problem is the people don't want to do that in the first place. I think that's a good way of disentangling those examples then.
Right, exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying.
So then the next category is the space and the Mars one that you brought up here. And this is one I'm very, very, very curious about. So, and this is why I'm combining the magic years and the book you're writing today. Once again, I was born in 1992. So all of my understanding of the 1960s comes from books and by speaking to folks like you. But as if I understand the 1960s, I'd love you to push back on this. I don't see how you can't do the Kennedy New Frontier thing and aim for the moon. Try to pass, once again, LBJ completes this, but at least try to pass Medicare, Medicaid, pursue civil rights at home. These are all deeply ambitious government-centric products that require public-spiritedness. I fail to see how you can disentangle that from the optimism of the space program. So, for example, we'll get into foreign policy a little later. You talk about how in your ideal world, we would draw back American commitments abroad and reinvest the money at home, climate change, healthcare, et cetera. But in an era where people basically don't think the government can do anything, I think that big projects like space are actually a key component of that public trust and public spiritedness. That's just kind of my initial pushback feeling. I'd love to hear your response.
Okay, so let's go back to JFK. And, you know, we need to go to the moon. So we were in a kind of existential technology race with the Soviet Union that had started when they put Sputnik up in 1958. And had not abated at all for 5, 6, 7 years. It was just like, are we the technological power that we say we are, or is communism really the place where the future is built? So I believe that Kennedy was kind of backed into that commitment. And so what were the supposed benefits of going to the moon? Well, we'd find out what was there, and could we go mine the rocks and or was there some exotic mineral that would make an energy future that was better or something like that? And along the way, people said, well, we invented Tang because we needed, powdered orange juice in a bag and that they could make. And that was an invention of the space race, right? Okay, so then we went to the moon. We brought back the rocks and there was nothing there. You know, the rocks were just rocks. And there was nothing, no exotic new minerals, nothing was any different. And so then we stopped going to the moon because it didn't make any sense economically to spend 7 million, 10 million, 50 million for each time to go there, you know? So now Musk says, okay, we need to go to Mars. And we say, why? And he says, we need to be a multi-planet species. Why? Well, he says, the Earth may collapse and, it may be impossible to live there. So we need to start a second community. So the cost for the first trip to go to Mars is $10 trillion. And then that's Elon's estimate. Mm-hmm. Now, where is that money going to come from? From NASA, right? You, the taxpayer, are going to pay for that. No venture capitalists in their right minds are going to pay for Elon to go to Mars because we don't know what would be there that would be of any use to us. We've got now the same issues. Oh, well, there'll be some rocks or we'll do space mining or something else. Okay, we'd have to go there. We'd have to live in a kind of biosphere-like dome because you couldn't go outside. The radiation is just too strong. You'd get cancer in 15 minutes. There's no oxygen. So we'd have to import hundreds and hundreds of tons of liquid oxygen just to supply 100 people in this biosphere dome. They'd be trapped in there. They couldn't go anywhere. And so the people at JPL, who I've spent a lot of time, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, would say, we should continue to send rovers, which we have done already, to Mars. They can dig for rocks. They can, analyze atmospheric radiation levels. They can do all those things. And besides, we don't need to get them back because that's half the problem. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's one thing to go to Mars, but how do you get back? How do you have enough fuel for the rockets? And besides, you don't have to keep people alive. Rovers don't need any oxygen, and they can do all the things. So there's an old saying at NASA, no Buck Rogers, no bucks. And the idea was that if you didn't have men heroically flying through space, but the public was never going to go for funding these missions. So this is Musk's thing. So let's say it costs $10 trillion. Musk is going to make $2 trillion as a profit because that's basically his basic profit margin and his NASA work so far is about 30%. So it makes no sense. There's no really legitimate scientists who think this is a must thing. And all it is an extension of, as I call it, the digital military industrial complex. And I know you and I may have different views on that, but for maybe 70 years since Paul Nietzsche wrote NSC 76, there have been companies who have profited mightily off of our need to be in a race with somebody. Soviet Union, now it's China. The more I read about China, the more I think it's a society with extraordinary economic problems. And yet we're making it up to be a frontline competitor with the United States and the whole vision of capitalism. And I think it's nonsense.
I think the way you told the story of the moon program was actually very helpful in this follow-up then, because, and by the way, I hate Tang. I've never enjoyed Tang as a millennial. I never kind of understood the We Got Tang. I always got the commercialized version in the store. I thought it was terrible. One of my least favorite lunch snacks. So I'm always going to be very skeptical of the Tang pitch. But I got on the more serious note of it. A, we've gotten several things from the goal of going to Mars. We've gotten SpaceX up to now, right? Which is reducing the cost of launch in the first place. So the cost of launch has fallen. You have a reinvigorated space program, which after the George W. Bush and the Obama administration was basically on the deathbed, it seems. You have Starlink, right? Like if you're in Ukraine right now, and there's a whole debate about whether or not Elon Musk should even control Starlink, people should check out Ronan Farrow's New Yorker piece on this. But like at a minimum, the end goal, the extreme goal of going to Mars has fundamentally transformed our world outside of the great power Cold War moon landing framework. So I'm curious what your response would be to those examples of like, these are very specific ways that the world's been made better by this crazy goal.
Well, look, there's no doubt that there needed to be competition in rocketry. Lockheed Martin and Boeing had kind of owned that for, you know, 30, 50 years. And so you get a new competitor, which is always a good thing. So what's the outcome? Now, SpaceX is the only platform to get people to the space station. Mm-hmm. He owns that business. He has a total monopoly on the space transportation business. In other words, so yes, was a new kid on the block, but then the other people recede, and you and I, it's the classic creative destruction Schumpeter analysis. Mm-hmm. The new kid comes in, undercuts everyone else in terms of cost structure, wins, and then becomes the monopolist. As far as Starlink is concerned, and this is reported in my book long before Ronan Farrow, when the Ukrainians started to get close to the Russian border, Elon took a map and drew a line and essentially geofenced the Starlink communication capability. So within 20 miles of the Russian border, all of a sudden, they had no communications. He made his own decision that he didn't want to piss off Putin, and so he shouldn't give them communications as they're going towards Russia. Now, whether an individual private actor should have the power to do that is something I think even the Army, the Pentagon worries about deeply. And Ronan, God bless him, did some really good reporting on that part. In terms of the concerns of the Defense Department on doing that. And, you know, obviously the concerns of the Ukrainians as well. So, I mean, the problem for me with Elon is he moved to where you live because he didn't want to pay California taxes, right? He says government's too big. It's too, everything needs to be given to private industry. And you described pretty well the privatization of the space business, right? All those heroic Apollo 11 movies that we saw, that was the United States running that show. Now it's all privatized. Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and to some extent,
Richard. Don't forget Richard.
own the space business, right? So is that a good thing or not? I have questions. It's the same as you know, Donald Rumsfeld wanted to use a lot of mercenaries and Blackwater people in Iraq. You know, was that a good thing or not? Maybe not. Okay, but the second thing is, Elon, for all his libertarian rhetoric and everything, is a crony capitalist. SpaceX, totally financed by NASA. You know, Starlink, totally financed by governments. Tesla sells carbon credits to every other automobile manufacturer and takes in about $4 billion a year. That is the difference between Tesla being a profitable company and not being a profitable company. Now, in terms of he's now making a deal for his plug-in stations all over the country and getting huge subsidies from the Department of Transportation for providing those to any other car. So he is a classic crony capitalist, and that's inconsistent with his libertarian rhetoric.
You know, a couple of things. So if one, we'll just go down the line. One, I'd love to hear what your publicly minded U.S. space status quo be, because to your point, I actually totally agree with you that it's a bad thing to have a complete privately owned dependence on SpaceX when it comes to getting the International Space Station lift, etc. There are market forces, like there's less things as public goods, and we don't want, for good or for ill, national security decisions to be made at the whim of a stock price or the price of Dogecoin week to week. So totally agree there. But before we were reliant on Elon Musk, we were reliant on the Russians for space lift, which I think is just 100 trillion times worse than that. So if either status quo, or if either the pre-Elon status quo or the Elon status quo isn't good, what's your alternative? Putting aside Mars, like what ideally would the situation look like today?
Well, look, I think the idea of having really good rocket capacity to go up, and let's say the James Webb Space Telescope had a problem, and it couldn't be fixed remotely. You'd have to send somebody up there and fix it. So you need rocket capacity, right? And maybe you'd fly a new version of the shuttle over there and get out there and fix it. But that's important because things like the James Webb Space Telescope are important to understand the origins of the universe and what's happening and why do things happen? So these things are crucial. And I'm not even against sending another version of the rover, the Mars rover, up there if we think we need a better version. I think the people I talk to at JPL say the one that's there is doing an incredible job, and all they need to do is send another mission up there to collect the 2 tons of rocks that the Mars rover has already dug up from the surface to bring them back to Earth. So that's something that doesn't need any humans. Okay, so I think I have no problem with there being private space ships. If Jeff Bezos wants to be a competitor to Musk in the heavy lift thing, he should do that, right? And if Musk makes as much money as I think he probably will make off of his work, other competitors should, if market forces make sense, should come into the market and maybe undercut his prices, you know? So I don't have any problem with Elon Musk per se. I just think that there's a gigantic gap between his rhetoric of small government, get out of my life, don't regulate me, and what he's really doing, which is saying, pay me money.
Yeah, and that's an interesting follow-up on the crony capitalism critique, because actually I think you entirely make that in good faith, but I actually dislike the generic critique of crony capitalism, because I think it really undercounts a certain governmental center left post New Deal, innovation, how the American system operates, which is that we have private actors We have public missions. We have a government. We have money. So the way that we win the technological aspect of the Cold War isn't through Soviet-style top-down design industrial bureaus that are 100% government owned and directed, like we partner with companies. Obviously, there's corruption. Things go too far. We won't even get into the like Blackwater part of the Iraq War. It's a whole other. I think, especially as we're seeing with the Wagner Group, there's. I think we should be really limited when it comes to the kinetic side of that. But just on the very public side of it, it seems like our system of private actors engaging in publicly funded missions actually works. And yes, Elon's a hypocrite, but I don't think we should be looking to Elon for his political philosophy or insights. I think if anything, a problem is a lot of people like in the broad public take the billionaires you articulate in the book too seriously. When it comes to those matters. So like in my ideal world, we'd say like, look, Elon, do SpaceX. I'm not going to judge you on your political consistency. So what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, Ross Douthat, and I don't know what you think about Ross, but I think
he's been on the podcast a couple of times. So I know Ross. Yeah.
He's a smart guy. He says that Elon Musk is without doubt the most powerful voice on the right in America.
Accurate.
Okay,
so one notification, because this has changed since you made that statement. Not just the most powerful voice, I'd say the most powerful actor, because of X and Twitter. And now he actually can turn the dials.
So this yesterday he wrote that the Jews were preventing, X, Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it, from succeeding. He literally said the ADL is behind the thing to keep me from getting any advertising. It's all the Jews' fault. Now, that is an extraordinary thing for someone to say in this day and age. So let's put aside Elon as a political actor. I think I have a lot of problems with it. And I think that the fact that, people can't really understand how it is that, 75% of the Republican Party still thinks that the election was stolen. They don't count the force of social media on most people's news consumption. In other words, the only way that could happen is that if 75% of the Republican Party are not getting actual news. They're getting feeds from their Twitter or Facebook accounts that tell them what to think. And that is really the problem that we have. And so I don't think that Musk has any right to be able to have the power he has. And let me say just one other thing. The conception of the internet itself was very kind of optimistic notion of your notion of bottom up, right? The government would build these protocols, TCP/IP, HTTP, and would basically just say, this is the way the internet works. That's what the government's role was. And they financed it out of the Army, the Defense Advanced Research Project. And then private actors would come in and it would all be bottom up and it would be completely decentralized and it would be networked and all those good words that, you and I both think are helpful. But what happened? Within 10 years, you had Google owning 92% of the search business. You had Facebook controlling 4 out of the largest 5 social networks. You had monopoly because you've studied Metcalfe's law as I have. Networks tend to get giant and everybody wants to be on the network where everyone else is. So I'm just saying that it just doesn't work the way theoretically it's supposed to work. We have all these Milton Friedman acolytes who think you just leave it all alone and the market will always deliver. But as well as I do that the market doesn't always deliver. And so there is a role for government to kind of be in there, and there is a role for the antitrust division. There is a role for the Federal Trade Commission. And that's kind of thing that you know, quite frankly, Elon doesn't like, and neither does Andreessen, and neither does Thiel, and neither does, Mark Zuckerberg.
I think so this is where I just want to do a quick sidebar. Full disclosure, despite my appearance, the last name tells it, I am Jewish, so I want to ask about the ADL question. So I'm going to play Elon for a second and say, look, Jonathan, were my tweets aggressive, offensive? You know me, that's my deal. Like, pretend you're your 1980s iteration and you're advising this big investor. This is Elon speaking then. Here's my problem right now. My problem right now is that the ADL as an organization is aggressively speaking to advertisers about the health and safety of this platform, which causes the platform and advertising revenue, because Twitter Blue has not worked out on a couple of different levels, to crash, which is really limiting the ability of me to actually run this site and make it a profitable business. Therefore, I have one of the biggest accounts on Twitter. I am going to use my voice to push back against the work of the ADL, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What is your, from at a business level, and this could also not just PR, I mean, like at a business level, like what would your advice be to him to navigate this situation without tweeting unhelpful tweets, which I will totally agree on?
So I would say, look, you came in and you basically eliminated the content moderation team. You fired them all. The head of content moderation finally quit. He tried to hang on for a while and then finally quit. And so then you're surprised when the ADL, which just monitors Twitter, says the rise in anti-Semitic language on Twitter has been on the level of 300 or 400% since you took it over. And you don't think they have a responsibility to push back against that? That's what their name is, the Anti-Defamation League. Their job is to point out where the sources of anti-Semitic rhetoric are coming from. And they're coming from Twitter. They're not coming from Facebook. They're coming from Twitter because Elon said, hey, everything's free speech, you know? And I'm a free speech absolutist. And that means that even if you're anti-Semitic, it's okay. You can be here on this platform. And so then you get what you ask for. And so I have no sympathy for him whatsoever that he's complaining now that the ADL is being somewhat effective in getting people not advertise on this putrid platform.
So it seems from a, you know, takeaways, because I know there are some folks at Twitter who listen to this podcast, it seems that the at a fundamental level, there's a trust collapse. So it's not just the ADL is showing up and, you know, talking to advertisers, and that is just sort of, they're just like, okay, you're right, we're not spending money anymore. There's been a cascade of events since the acquisition that have just broken that trust between the advertising teams and Twitter. Because once again, they want to sell it. These are capitalist companies, right? They want to sell things. So there's something broadly going on here. And what Musk cannot assure these companies is, hey, if you advertise here, you're not going to have a massive scandal in 6 months. So it seems the advice would really just be, recognize what went wrong here. Recognize that like a pitched Twitter battle with the ADL probably isn't going to end well. And at a minimum, do the hard work of figuring out how do you balance the desire to have a platform that's centered around speech with the need to pay the bills. And I also would have helped if they were going to do the route they took, they really shouldn't have turned Twitter Blue into a tribalist enterprise where it's like, that was the dumbest thing. Like, why? I don't understand why you didn't just come in and say, look, guys, we're all, because you know, the funny thing is, if you read your books, there was already a bipartisan consensus that advertising driven social media wasn't already a good thing. So it seems that you could have just come in and said, hey guys, let's have this thing paid by subscribers, by people who want to be here, people who want to support the community. We don't want to be dependent on advertising. But by making it into red team, blue team, that instantly nuked the ability to kind of follow the New York Times model. So I think that's really relevant. So in our last section, I want to hit the two other areas substantively, but quickly. I think the most frustrating area is the transhumanism category. And I've had Balaji Srinivasan on the podcast, so you can say things that I'm not quite comfortable saying as someone inviting me, someone into my home, but just give a summary of your transhumanism critique.
Well, Francis Fukuyama, as you probably know, wrote The End of History, says that transhumanism is the most dangerous idea in history. And what we mean by transhumanism is the general effort to change the human body to make it able to live to 200 years old instead of 100 years old, to be able to design your embryo to have certain genetic qualities such as intelligence or lack of male pattern baldness, or be very fast, have very good twitch response, so you can be a fast runner. You know, all these things exist today. CRISPR allows you to do these things. Now, the ethicists say you shouldn't do it, but they all exist. And there are some rogue scientists who are playing around with it, you know? So, but the next thing is what Ray Kurzweil at Google calls the singularity, which is this notion at some point, and he says, you know, 2040, the artificial intelligence will be much smarter than humans, and that we will no longer be the dominant species. And so people like Peter Thiel are looking into some way of merging their own consciousness into the AI, so that even if their body went away, Peter Thiel could keep running Palantir. Even if his, I mean, he hopes very much to live to 160 or 180, right? And he's going down to San Diego to get blood transfusions from 20-year-old boys in order, because he's proven at his lab that, you know, old mice stay alive longer if they get transfusions from young mice, right? So, but he's also working with people who believe that they can send nanobots into your body to fix certain problems that happen in your liver or someone like that. The point of the notion that we end up merging human with computers seems to me problematic. I think all four of these people really are looking to replace nature with technology, to rebuild the society in such a way that few of them, the people who own the AIs, would fulfill the most primal human dream, to be gods. When Ray Kurzweil was asked, did he believe in God? He said, not yet. And so they actually believe that we're going to enter this age of spiritual machines, as Kurzweil says. So these God machines that will tell us what to do, that will run the society, will do all of that. To me, that's something I don't want. And you know, in the town that I live in, which is Los Angeles, we're seeing kind of an existential risk right now. What are these two Hollywood strikes about? Well, on the Writers Guild side, the Marvel Cinematic Universe would like the possibility of putting every Marvel screenplay that was ever written into a large language model. And then instead of a screenwriter, they'd have a prompt writer. And that person would say, okay, let's make a new screenplay, and the Hulk will meet Captain America in Iceland, and then Black Widow comes in and, you know, gives it a 4-paragraph prompt. And in a day, the AI will spit out a screenplay. Now, Marvel owns that screenplay 100%, doesn't have to pay any royalties to anybody else and everything. But of course, that screenplay will not be any better than the bad T.S. Eliot poems that you can create on ChatGPT. So they will then, because there will be lots of screenwriters out of work, they will hire some good screenwriter for $10,000 a week for 3 weeks to make it more human. And they will also gain the advantage of actually getting a human's name on it too, because the copyright office says it won't copyright something that's purely written by a machine. And then they solve their problems. They've cut their costs radically. They've cut the time to market radically. But the artists will be out of work. Now, I can say just one thing, having worked with Bob Dylan, who I consider to be a genius, ChatGPT will never write like a Rolling Stone. It will never write Hamlet, because AI believes that all the human knowledge that's ever been needed or ever will be needed is already out there on the internet. And the idea of these large language models is simply to remix it and put one word in front of next to another and make something that is just enough new that it doesn't cross the copyright thing. The same thing with these image generators, you know. So I think we're at a really critical point. I'm not worried about AI taking over the world and you know, that's something other people to worry about. But I am worried about AI eliminating huge number of jobs. I mean, I've been to an Amazon R&D facility where there's five people and 5,000 robots, and it works just fine, you know. And it doesn't escape me that the people who are pushing universal basic income the most are Mark Zuckerberg, Mark Andreessen, Peter Thiel, and Elon Musk, because they see where the future is going. So there's two futures on offer. One is which we put the collective public goods, as you call them, to fixing the problems of this planet, eliminating homelessness, getting the air cleaned up, you know, getting the rivers cleaned up, all these things that we know how to do. And the other is that the future will be a world in which most people will not have a job, and they will sit at home and live on universal basic income, maybe paid in crypto if Mark Andreessen has his way. And from Zuckerberg's point of view, it'll be great, because they'll sit at home and maybe they'll go on into the metaverse and date Kim Kardashian and you know, pretend they're Tony Stark. That is not a world I want to live in. Now, I'm 76, so I probably won't have to deal with this, but you will.
I think the last questions. So one, this is just a follow-up to the Francis Fukuyama quote that you invoke in the book and kind of discourse on. The key takeaway and why that was so scary for me was this idea that it's hard to have, in a world where people are able to like augment themselves or change their inherentness, it really limits the democratic nature of so much of what Western liberal society is premised on when it comes to like equality, inherent human dignity, those different things. I'm curious what you think in the world today, like what the limits are, because like to a certain degree, like the fact that I could send my kids to super expensive private school versus some kid goes to some crappy public school. Like, what do you just think about like what how far can we stretch the world we live in today, the world of reality, before you think we start stretching the nature of what makes a democracy work?
Well, look, if you and your wife decided when you have another child, I don't know if you have kids or not. Or
just got married, no kids yet, but hopefully.
when you guys decide and they do a genetic test on the embryo and they say, oh, this embryo has a 40% chance of male pattern baldness, it will be in the 50 percentile of the SAT test. It will be have blonde hair that will eventually fall out, but again, whatever, you know. And you say, well, I want to improve that. I want to improve. And they say, okay, for $1 million, we could fix that. We could make him in the 90th percentile of the SAT test. We can make sure he's not going to be bald. You know, okay, you could do that. At that point, Thomas Jefferson goes out the window. All men are created equal is not true. And by the way, if Peter Thiel can live to 170 years old and keep running Palantir, what does that mean for all the young people trying to come up and make it in the companies? If my damn generation can continue to hang on forever, we've hung on too long. What is the problem? We've got a gerontocracy. It's like the Soviet Union and the Andropov era. You know, all these 85-year-old politicians, and, you know, I'm a Democrat, but I'm not happy with the fact that this guy won't give it up and let someone else come on. Then, so, I mean, and you know, Mitch McConnell is going to hang on. Doesn't matter if he freezes every week. And, you know, in front of the microphone, he's probably just not going to do any press conferences for a while, you know. I worry. I have a lot of worry. But on the other hand, I see a resistance, Marshall. I see the people on the picket lines in Hollywood are saying no to AI. I see that young musicians and young chefs trying to make, and you see it in Austin, trying to make a non-industrialized music and a non-industrialized food system. I see all sorts of hope all over the country of people saying, I'm not going to just put on my headphones and listen to Spotify all day. I'm going to learn how to play the banjo. You know, I mean, you know, I spent a lot of time with Rhiannon Giddens. She's like, to me, she's a light in the darkness, you know, and that makes me feel good. I feel that there's people that are pushing back.
So here's the closing question, which I'll merge into one semi-giant one. I've spoken to a lot of young founders and builders in the crypto space. So not the, well, I've spoken to Mark, but we didn't talk about crypto in that context. And something they really like to do is they frame what they're doing in the language and specific historical analogy to what you and your cohort did in the 1960s. Crypto, especially in New York, in LA, is very countercultural in the way it articulates itself. It says, hey, look, like, we're trying to decentralize these big Web 2 platforms. Web 3 is going to be more decentralized, all those different aspects. And the way I would kind of ask you to close this is, my biggest frustration when I've spoken with them is they haven't understood Daniel Patrick Monahan issue of politics being downstream from culture. Because many of the arguments that they kind of think are like cultural are actually like deeply political ones, like, oh, like, we're going to have build a DAO that's going to buy the Constitution. And it's so great that we'll vote where it goes. Well, but wait, guys, like, whoever has the most ownership via the tokens would actually have the most votes. So actually, that's like not a particularly useful political structure. So I'll just ask you to close on the Monahan quote, like, politics, technology, culture, those are the three places you've placed your career in. What's the order? Like, what's downstream of what? How should we think about that moving forward?
Well, you know, there's an old quote from the business world, culture eats strategy for breakfast every morning. And I think it makes a lot of sense. In other words, you can have a strategy for your company and say, this is what we're going to do. But if your culture is screwed up, it won't make any difference. People won't eat the dog food. You know, I mean, here's what I think about crypto. First, it's not decentralized. You know, as Dorsey Jack Dorsey said, you don't own Web3. The VCs do. It will never escape their incentive. It's ultimately a centralized entity with a different label. Okay, so that's the first thing. The second thing is, if you recall, in the winter of 2021, as football season was getting to a climax, the football games were flooded with ads for FX and crypto.com and all the other exchanges. There was Tom Brady telling you should be in crypto, and there was Matt Damon saying fortune belongs to the bold, and Larry David and LeBron and Steph Curry, and everywhere you look, there were ads pushing Bitcoin. Now, at that point, Bitcoin was at 60,000 a coin. And so you put $250 million of TV advertising. There was so much advertising that they called the Super Bowl in 2022 the Crypto Bowl, right? So the suckers flood in. It's a classic pyramid scheme, right? The suckers flood in, buying at $60,000 a coin. The 2% of the people that own 90% of the Bitcoin sell a huge amount of their coins, which they got for almost nothing because they were in at the beginning of the game. And by May, Bitcoin is at $19,000 a coin. So the proles that came in after the advertising flood lost most of their money. And of course, the whales that own most of the Bitcoin made out like bandits. So what's the purpose of it? It has no, as the scientists wrote, as you saw in the beginning of my book, said, it has no real purpose for a large-scale financial transaction platform. All it is playing on this nonsense idea, which Ron Paul floated 20 years ago, that the dollar is a false construct and it's all going to fall apart. Now, he's saying this for 25 years, and of course, it never happened. But that doesn't stop people from playing on that same fear that the government is somehow hiding something and you know, the dollar is going to completely collapse at some point. At least when you bought gold, you could melt it down and make some jewelry. You buy Bitcoin, you can't do anything with it.
I think that is you think that ultimately, I think that's a great place to end the podcast. Can you just, since we've talked about a couple of your books, could you obviously just shout out the full title of The End of Reality and then, of course, The Magic Years too?
Yeah. So, The End of Reality, how 4 billionaires are selling a fantasy future of the metaverse, Mars, and crypto. It goes on sale today. The Magic Years, Scenes from a Rock and Roll Life, which is a history of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, both in music and in movies.
Excellent. Jonathan, thank you for joining me on The Realignment.
This has been a delight. Thank you very much.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.